Sanam, dear listeners, I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I welcome you to this week's Thursday Live segment. I am not in the studio right now, and I'm not coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam as I always do. And this week I am not going to be able to do the Gita series episode 2. I sincerely apologize for that. Instead, I'm going to play for you a talk that I had the opportunity to deliver a couple of weeks back. This talk was on the topic to be a yogi and not a bhogi. And as the title itself suggests, there are a lot of references to the couple of chapters that we just concluded, the third chapter and the second chapter. And I hope you'll find this talk as a good revision of what we have covered, the concepts that we have covered in those two chapters. Over now to the talk on the topic to be a yogi and not a bhogi. I'll join you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of the Gita series. We are in the end of the fourth chapter and we'll continue from where we left off last week. Till then, I hope you enjoy this talk. Happy listening. I offer my most loving pranams in Bhagwan's lotus feet. I pray to Swami that He gives us all the understanding, that is, it is He who speaks and it is He who listens through all of us. Elders, sisters and brothers, Sairam to all of you. Swami tells a very sweet chinnakatha, which is more of an analogy really, where He says there is this small pond, and in that pond live three fishes. One day one of the fishes tells the other two fishes that it looks like the water in the pond is drying up. We need to find a larger pond to save ourselves. The second fish says that let us face the trouble when it comes. And when it comes, I think I can deal with it. And the third fish is in complete denial. It says that that's never going to happen. Right now we are happy, we are peaceful, we are enjoying. Why bother about tomorrow? Swami says one fine day, a fisherman comes, catches the third fish, which was completely unprepared. The second fish was a little smart, so it tears through the net and escapes, but briefly. The first fish, which was smart, moved to a larger tank before the fisherman could come. Swami says those three fishes, the first one being sattva, the second one being rajas, the third one is tamas. The pond itself represents life, the drying water, the time which is running out. And the fisherman is yama or death, who comes unannounced. A very, very beautiful analogy. This is a way of looking at either three kinds of people: a sattvic person, a rajasic person, a tamasic person. Another way of looking at it is all these three qualities are within us, instructing us, and the choice is left to each which one we choose to obey. It seems that the choice is all important, isn't it? Because when we look at ourselves, we look at our lives, what is it that defines us? If you look at a person, how do we say a person is a good person, a bad person, a cunning person, a cruel person, a spiritual person? How do we give these tags to people? Is it based on what we wear? Is it based on where we live? Is it based on how we speak, how we carry ourselves? Certainly choices make a very, very important, play a very important role in our lives. Because as Swami would say, the choices we make are an expression of our thinking. Nobody will know our mind otherwise. It is in the choices that we make, we open to the world what is happening in our mind. But even then, the choices cannot define us. There is this beautiful chapter in Satyam Shivam Sundaram, I think it's in the first or second volume, where a beautiful episode in Swami's life, where he transforms a criminal who is on the run and promises to help him and sends him back to the police to surrender. It's a story which I think most of you would be aware of a person by name Kalpagiri. So he goes back to prison, but into those abandoned walls of a prison, he takes the devotion of Swami. And in a matter of few months, all those inmates of the prison, discarded by society for whatever different crimes they've performed, start turning towards Swami. They start doing bhajans. They start doing namasmarana. They start writing letters to Swami, and Swami starts responding. It's a chapter called Wounded Wings, where to many of those prisoners, Swami himself wrote letters. Swami sent them japamalas. Swami sent them pictures of his own. Swami sent Satyam Shivam Sundaram. One of those prisoners, Professor Kasturi writes about, is a man who, in a moment of fury, he had a fight, an argument with his wife. He gets very, very angry. In that anger, he kills his wife. He takes a knife and he slits her throat. And he himself does not wish to live any further, so he tries to stab himself. But unfortunately for him, it doesn't kill him. The police come and capture him. So he is arrested. He is then put in a hospital where he could recoup. And once he is recovered enough, they put him in the prison. And this person starts getting completely drawn towards Swami. And because of this injury that he had caused to himself, the doctors say that you cannot eat normal food. So the doctors prescribe a diet of boiled grams and saltless dal. So in one of the letters, this prisoner writes to Swami. He says, "Swami, till this moment, I thought I was doomed. I thought I had no hope. But today I see that everything had a purpose so that one day I could come face to face with you." And then he writes, "This is the prescription of the doctor to me." He says that I should eat saltless food and boiled grams. What a blessing in disguise it is, because as I have read, a sattvic food is important for a spiritual life. You have ensured that even in this prison life, I am able to follow all of these things. Talking about some of these prisoners, because many of the organizations all around the world take up the seva of going to prisons and serving prisoners there. So talking to one such group which had gone to a prison and served prisoners, Swami was speaking about them, and Swami said, in one reckless moment, these people have done a heinous crime. The compassionate Lord that Swami is, Swami said, they're not bad people. They made one mistake in their life. But when we look at them as criminals for life. It was one moment that defined their life in our eyes. So if one choice was to define our lives, can we say that the prisoner who is rejoicing the opportunity to chant Swami's name and eat sattvic food, is he any way lower than anybody who's living scot-free in the society, who's earning a lot of money, who's probably earning it in an adharmic way, an unrighteous way? Just because somebody has even committed a murder. So even a choice, even one act, might from the worldly point of view define our lives, but it does not necessarily define our lives from the true sense. So if we want to lead a spiritual life, if we wish to lead the life of a yogi, what defines it? I think it was sometime in the 50s and 60s when yoga became very popular in the West. Right? That was a time when a lot of Westerners started visiting the city of Rishikesh. Rishikesh later came to be called the yoga capital of the world. So the entire world started taking a fascination for yoga, and they started calling themselves yogis just because they practice one aspect of yoga. Swami would say there are many yogas, many approaches to yoga, one of which is Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. And in that, Ashtanga Yoga, one aspect is the asana. So that cannot define one being a yogi. So what defines a life of a yogi? The classic scene of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna was telling Arjuna to fight. Arjuna also was under this misconception that one choice defines a spiritual life. The attire decides a spiritual life. The kind of actions that you do alone define a spiritual life. Because he said, I want to leave this battlefield. I want to wear ochre robes. I will beg for my food. I will sit in the forest. And thereby I will become a spiritual person. And Krishna advises him and says that it's completely wrong. It's a misconception on your part. And thereby he guides him and he says, I will teach you a way by which you can be a true yogi. The instruction that Krishna gives Arjuna in the battlefield, he says, Satatam yoginaha. Be a yogi at all times. And he says, I am going to teach you how that can be achieved. Sometime back somebody forwarded an interesting joke. It said, I signed up to a gym 6 months ago and I'm appalled to note that there is no change in me. 6 months I've signed up to the gym and there's no change in me. I think I will have to go tomorrow to the gym myself and find out what's happening. I think that is what we all do with our lives. I have come and settled in Puttaparthi. I have chosen Swami. I am wearing whites. I am working in the ashram. Is that enough? Does that define a spiritual life? A spiritual life is not about one choice, but it is about one choice defining our life. If we look at life as a journey, which is the best way to look at it, because a lot of spiritual understanding comes with looking at life as a journey. So if we were to look at life as a journey, what defines a journey? There are many aspects to a journey. There's the speed at which the journey is being made, the conveyance being used, the comfort of the conveyance, who is accompanying you, what do you do in the journey, do you stop somewhere, do you eat something? But none of this really defines the journey. What really defines the journey is the destination. As I always say, if I start from here, and let's say I'm taking a cab and I'm on my way to Bangalore. A friend calls me, I'm at the Ganesh Gate. Where are you going? I'm going to Bangalore. I'm midway, somebody calls me, what are you doing? I'm going to Bangalore. I'm just 1 kilometer away from Bangalore, somebody asks me, what are you doing? I'm going to Bangalore. So whichever section or whichever part of the journey I might be in, it is defined by the destination. So a true yogi is always defined by his eyes or her eyes being fixed upon the destination. And Swami would say, yoga, the word yoga itself means union with God or union with the Supreme, union with the ultimate. So a yogi is one who knows that the destination of this journey is yoga. And once when the destination is fixed, the route will be taken accordingly, isn't it? The direction of the journey at each point will be defined by the destination. So a yogi looks at his life and he says, if yoga is the destination, what am I supposed to do in each stage of this journey? So the choices that are made are defined by this destination one sets for oneself. So that destination starts defining each turn one takes in one's life. And there is another very, very important aspect. Apart from destination, apart from the direction, if I am driving a vehicle, I need to have control over that vehicle. I might know where I want to go, but to be able to take my vehicle to that place, I should have control over the vehicle. So after having fixed the destination, after making the choices, the ability to live life by those choices needs one to take control over oneself. Control over one's body and control over one's mind. Because without that, there is nothing that can be done. If the body and mind do not obey me, how can I lead it to any place? But if you'd happen to read the topic before you come in, it said, to be a yogi and not to be a bhogi. It's a very important and very interesting approach that all the Vedantic scriptures take. That is, one is the assertion of what you're supposed to be, and the other is denouncing what you're not supposed to be. Both of these are very, very important. We've all heard Swami telling in his discourses, Swami would say, don't be an animal, be a man. Right? And whenever Swami would say this, he would say these two together. He would say, don't be an animal, be a man. If you look at all the Vedantic scriptures, even the Bhagavad Gita, you would always find these instructions coming in pairs. If you do this, this will happen. If you don't do this, you will get ruined. Because it is an approach that life has to be looked at with, where you say, this is what has to be done, and this has to be removed from the picture. So I have to be a yogi. What is it to be a yogi? I must also define what is it to be a bhogi and ensure that I don't get lost in that kind of a lifestyle. That is why it is important to assert to be a yogi and also dismiss being a bhogi. So what is it to be a bhogi then? We'll come back to being a yogi because that is the most important thing. But what is it to be a bhogi? The word bhoga in Sanskrit means pleasures. So it's everyone who enjoys pleasures. Does everyone who enjoys and gets lost in pleasures become a bhogi? We all probably sleep in air-conditioned rooms. We all have air-conditioned cars. We eat tasty food. Does that make us a bhogi? Just like how one choice does not define a yogi, pleasures alone do not define a bhogi. There are three qualities. There could be, you could expand them to cover more, but I think I will keep it to three qualities that I'd like to talk about that defines the nature of a bhogi. Going back to life as a journey, for a yogi, yoga is the destination. For a bhogi, bhoga is the destination. Which means whatever a bhogi does, he does only with the ends of pleasures in mind. Enjoying pleasures is not wrong, but thinking that pleasures are ends by themselves is the most dangerous mistake. And I think this is something which Swami has spoken extensively about. you have good food. There is pleasure that comes with food, but the purpose behind food is nourishment for the body. Sleeping is actually a pleasure, but there is a purpose behind sleep that is again restfulness for the body and the mind. Similarly, there are any number of pleasures we go through in life, but each pleasure is always attached to a purpose. A bhogi is one who looks at a pleasure and says, the pleasure is complete in itself. Who does the mistake of removing the pleasure and goes, removing the purpose and goes after the pleasure. So the first mistake a bhogi does, or a first mistake by which a bhogi is defined, is this nature of looking at pleasure as a purpose in itself, as an end in themselves. This nature of a bhogi leads one to choose the immediate pleasure over a long-term purpose, isn't it? Swami would often say, early in the morning you wake up. If you wake up, if you have the opportunity to do a little bit of prayer early in the morning, or if you're a student, you get up and study in the morning, there are benefits that are to be got from it. But the benefits that come from it come over a long period of time. But then there is an immediate pleasure to be got. The joy of sleeping for a little longer. Right? So a bhogi is one, because he is driven by this desire for pleasure, he very, very easily gives up the long-term purpose or the long-term benefit for a short-term benefit. This is defined in Vedanta, and Swami would say this, as choosing prayers over shreyas. Constantly in life, we will be faced with these two choices that we have to choose from. One is an immediate pleasant benefit, and a long-term benefit or a long-term purpose. A yogi is one who is able to constantly choose shreyas over prayas. A bhogi is one who says, who knows about tomorrow, the pleasure is in front of me, let me enjoy it. And the third mistake, or the third characteristic of a bhogi, which is coming out of this nature, is that a bhogi is completely given to his or her own likes and dislikes. How do you define pleasure? How do you define something that gives you joy? Something I like gives me joy. When something I dislike happens to me, I see that as pain. Something which I abhor, which I don't like, which I want to run away from, if it happens to me, I call it a disaster. There is something that I seek very, very passionately. When I get it, I define my happiness by that, acquiring that pleasure, right? And these two are referred to as raga and dvesha. And Swami very beautifully says that people think that their lives are ruled by the Navagrahas. No, their lives are ruled by only two grahas, raga and dvesha, your likes and dislikes. Because you're constantly making choices, running away from situations, running towards situations, doing things, trying to acquire things, only based on what I like, what I don't like. And Swami says, so much so, we become a slave to these two likes and dislikes. So a bhogi is defined by these three things. One is, he looks at pleasures as ends in themselves. Because he looks at pleasures as ends in themselves, he starts choosing the short-term benefit over a long-term purpose. And because of this, he becomes a slave to his likes and dislikes. So a yogi is somebody who overcomes all these three characteristics of a bhogi, isn't it? So each of these, there is a methodology by which they have to be tackled. First and foremost, going back to what defines a yogi, as we said, a yogi is defined by his acknowledgement that there is something to be attained beyond this world. The acknowledgement of yoga as the destination is the first definition of a yogi, right? Without the recognition of something which is higher than this worldly plane and worldly existence, there can be no yoga abhyasam. There can be no practice of yoga. One can be a good bhogi, right? One can be a good bhogi really in that sense. There's nothing wrong. A lot of youngsters today are in that place, right? They have a lot of money to spend, probably come from their parents, or they earn a lot, and they indulge in pleasures, and they indulge in pleasures without hurting anybody around, right? They do not take to immoral ways, they probably do not cheat others. They say, it's my money, my hard-earned money, and I'm buying pleasures and I'm filling my life with them. So it is quite possible to, in that sense, be a good bhogi. But Swami says, when you go out of control from being a bhogi, Swami says you become a rogi, right? You become diseased. You're so attached to pleasures that you don't see that it is spoiling your health, it's spoiling your life itself. But it is possible, I feel, to maintain yourself as a good bhogi. But going back to that analogy that Swami gave of the three fishes in a pond. If you're a bhogi, you tell, I will deal with it when it comes. When a situation comes, I will deal with it. Yes, when a situation comes, the analogy is very, very beautiful, the way Swami says. Because it looks at the pond and it says there's enough water. Probably it'll take 2 or 3 summers before this dries up. But death comes unannounced, right? That's why Swami says death is not the drying up of the pond. Death is the fisherman who comes. And he comes unannounced. So if you're a bhogi, Swami says, you're caught unannounced and you get stuck in that position. There is no growth. If any movement happens, it will only be towards roga. So to go from being a bhogi to becoming a yogi, one has to acknowledge that there is something more than what this world can offer. There is something more than what can be gained in this world, in this lifetime. So that is a fundamental prerequisite for being a yogi, isn't it? As Swami would say, bhoga in itself is not a problem. Pleasures in itself need not necessarily become an obstacle. Swami uses a very beautiful word. Swami says, aparimitam. Aparimitamaina bhogam, Swami would say. Parimita means within limits. Aparimita means beyond limits. And he says the problem comes when these pleasures go beyond limits. So how does the yogi define the limits? Right? Because a yogi too enjoys pleasure. If I were to go back to the analogy of a journey, once I have fixed my destination, I think it is completely alright for me to choose a comfortable ride. I go to the bus stand and I say I want to go to Bangalore. Within my means, there is nothing wrong in choosing a comfortable bus. But it will become very, very wrong if I look at a comfortable bus and say, this bus looks comfortable, I will go wherever this bus takes me. In that case, we make bhoga define our journey. But if we define our destination and say, okay, this is the destination I want to get, this is how soon I have to get there, this is the means I have, this is the amount of money I have with me, and I can afford this pleasure. So Swami says, a yogi does indulge in pleasure, but always as long as it does not compromise the purpose of his life, right? When it comes to this concept of choosing shreyas over prayas, this probably is the most real problem that all of us face in our life today. Talking about karma yoga, Krishna gives Arjuna the advice of karma yoga. He says, You know, you can continue to do whatever you're supposed to do, but you can become a yogi. Right? He teaches him what is referred to as Buddhir Yoga. He says, I'm going to give you Buddhir Yoga, and with this you can do anything. If you're a king, you can be a Karma Yogi king. If you're a farmer, you can be a Karma Yogi farmer. So learn this Buddhir Yoga. Don't worry about the choices that you make. They will all fall into place. But when he teaches him this, he tells a very beautiful point. He says, what will stop you from doing this? Krishna is the Lord himself, the Supreme Master. He stands in front of Arjuna and gives him the advice. And he says, see, this is the best advice I can give you. This is the best instruction a master can give a disciple. If you follow this, you will reach the goal. If you don't follow this, you will be getting caught in the delusion. And then Krishna says, what stops one? God is in front of you. You have acknowledged God. You have acknowledged that what comes from God is most supreme. But what stops you? Krishna says, asuya stops you. That's a beautiful, very subtle point he makes. He says, jealousy stops you. A person gets distracted by jealousy. When I am trying to be a good person, to be a good person, one will always have to choose Shreyas over Prayas, right? Let us say I am working in the government office, and all of us do work for the remuneration, right? There is no doubt about that. At the end of the month, you have a pay with which you nourish your family. So certainly we all work for that. Swami would call that Jivitam, right? A salary is called Jivitam because you lead your life based on that remuneration that you get. So certainly all of us work for that remuneration. So I'm in a government office, I'm waiting for that salary, but next to me is one person who has other means of making money. Not the right means, but there are plenty of other means of making money. Taking bribes and doing favors and receiving benefits for that. So here you are trying to focus on the path, trying to constantly choose Shreyas over Prayas. But just next to you is a person who is making enormous amounts of money and he seems to be very well off. Nothing is going wrong with his life. He's taking a lot of bribes, he's probably becoming richer, his children are probably going to better schools than your children, he's wearing better clothes than you. So Krishna says, you become jealous of a person who is choosing Prayas over Shreyas. One who is trying to follow the path of yoga gets jealous of a bhogi. Right? This question always comes to our mind, why is it that bad people flourish in this world? Is there anybody here who has not had that question in their mind? Why is it that bad people flourish and good people seem to be suffering? Because the essential choice a good person makes is, I am letting go of the benefit right now for the benefit of the future, of the overlying benefit, right? The overpowering benefit. But the bad man is constantly choosing the immediate benefit. So obviously he leads a life of pleasure. It seems like he seems more successful until time catches up, of course. So it will always look like the person who chooses Prayas over Shreyas is having a very, very good life. And that is the greatest distraction that is there in front of us. Can I choose purpose in life in spite of that distraction? That is why Swami says, one of the tools that the yogi always has is he knows that the world is unreal. The yogi has it so easy, right? Because he's so clear in his mind. He knows that the world is unreal. So the world does not tempt him at all. The wealth is unreal. The fame that comes to us is unreal. So the yogi is never tempted at all. But for us, these distractions are real. Every day we have to battle these distractions and be able to choose right over wrong. There's another very beautiful question that Arjuna asks in the course of this entire discourse which Krishna is giving him, which I think is there in all of our minds, or we will face this question or ask this question at some point. He says, Krishna, you're telling me all this, I know that it is right, but why am I not able to follow it? I know I have to wake up early in the morning, why am I not able to wake up? I know I have to exercise every day, why am I not being able to exercise? I know I have to choose good over bad, why am I constantly choosing good even though I know it is wrong? And Krishna gives this very example, this very reason. He says, he of course rephrases it this time, he says, the desires that are born out of Rajoguna become an obstacle. The desires that are born out of Rajoguna, which means the mind is constantly going outward. You're constantly looking at people around. Oh, he has a good car. He's living a comfortable life. That person is wearing expensive clothes. This person's children are studying abroad. What am I doing? Right? The nature of the mind is to constantly look around. That is the rajasic nature of the mind. And Krishna says, it is this nature of the mind which stops you from being able to do what is right. And very beautifully Krishna says, it is like an enemy. And this enemy has captured three of your fortresses, you can say. He says, it captures the senses, it captures the mind, and it captures the intellect. How does it capture the senses? He says the senses is captured by its strong likes and dislikes, raga and dvesha. How does it conquer the mind? I see something, I start desiring for it, I go back home, but the mind doesn't stop thinking about it. The mind is constantly contemplating about it repeatedly again and again. That becomes a distraction. Right? And slowly it goes into the buddhi or the intellect. And when it goes to the intellect is now not able to clearly define what is right and wrong. Because now the intellect is being drawn by the senses and the mind. Otherwise the intellect is very clear. Intellect knows that this is right, this is wrong, this is prayas, this is shreyas. But now with this distracted mind, the senses going awry, the mind being disturbed, the intellect also falls a prey. So all this is well defined. This is what we all are. But what are we supposed to do? Right? That's the question that we probably would all love answers to. When you look at a yogi, the yogi first of all starts with, Swami says, there is no raga and dvesha. Right? That is precise definition of a yogi. There is nothing he likes, there is nothing he does not like. You ask him to live in a palace, he is happy. You ask him to live in a hut, he is happy. You give him a royal banquet, he is happy. You give him no food, he is happy. In other words, he has conquered raga and dvesha. There is no raga and dvesha. So he likes and accepts everything. Because there is no raga and dvesha, the mind is absolutely clear. And because the mind is absolutely clear, the intellect is absolutely focused. But we are not like that. We all have raga and dvesha. It need not necessarily be bad likes and dislikes or bad attachments and fears. But nevertheless, we all have likes and dislikes. We like to live in a clean house. We like to eat decent food. We like certain types of individuals. We like people who speak lovingly and kindly. Right? These are all legitimate likes and dislikes, but nevertheless, these are raga and dvesha. So Swami says that you will have to try to go towards a yogic life from where you are. I cannot look at a yogi who is living in the Himalayas and say, I want to become like him. Right? You cannot say, let me dress like him, let me grow a long beard like him, then I will become a yogi. Swami says you'll have to start from where you are and try to progress towards that state. And speaking about this, Swami gives a very, very beautiful insight into one of the Upanishads, where Swami says the Ishavasi Upanishad gives a very, very practical and beautiful way by which this can be acquired, or this can be done. Swami refers to the very first verse, where I'm sure all of you must have heard this. This is why the name of the Upanishad itself comes. Where Swami says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam jagat tena tyaktena bhunjita ma gridaha kasya sviddhanam. Swami says, in these are three instructions, and later on in the Upanishad there are a couple of instructions which are very profound, which is for people like you and me who have raga and dvesha, who are in the world, we cannot go away from here, who have impressions in the mind which cannot be dismissed, but still have a desire to have a life which is aligned towards yoga. So he says the first thing is, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yatkincha Jagatyam Jagat. He says, you have the desire to reach God, let's say. So Swami says, the first and foremost is the acknowledgement that whatever you see in this world is actually God. Whatever you see, the entire creation is a garment of God. It is being worn by God. This is a very, very important point, because it said that this itself will ensure that you don't try to run away from your current situation. It is there to be found now and here. You don't have to give up what you're doing in search of that. As I was telling somebody just yesterday, there are so many centers all around the world, samitis, to which Swami has given his own robe, right? Swami is to distribute his robe to so many of those people. Even now, if you go to these centers, you will have Swami's robe framed, or it will be kept on the chair. It is revered just like Swami. Why? Because we look at it as Swami's garment. So Swami says, look at this entire world, yakkincha jagatyam jagat. Everything that is moving in this world, which means every living being, is nothing but a garment of Lord. God is wearing all of these forms that you see all around you. So that is the first attitude one has to develop. The second point Swami says is, tena tyaktena bhunjita. This is actually the most important point which Swami says the Ishavasya Upanishad teaches. Enjoy pleasures. The literal meaning of that line is, by renunciation, this world should be enjoyed. Through renunciation, tena tyaktena, tyaktena means through the act of renunciation, bhunjitaha, enjoy this world. Swami says this is the most operative command, where you bring together tyaga and bhoga. Enjoyment and renunciation is brought together. You don't have to run away from these pleasures, but be ever ready to give up these pleasures. Right? That's the beautiful. Enjoy it as much as it is there, but when a time comes when it has to be given away, be ready to give it away. Tena tyaktena bhunjitaha. Through renunciation, enjoy this world. Swami says, it's like an oxymoron. Bhoga is pleasure, tyaga is sacrifice. How can you bring those two together? Swami says, yes, it is possible. And that is given in the very next line. He says, ma grida kasya sviddhanam. Do not covet anybody's wealth. Which means go through this life with a feeling that whatever is given to you for only that moment. You do not own anything. A sense of trusteeship towards our relationships, towards our wealth, towards our comforts. Yes, today it has come to me. As long as it lasts, I will enjoy. When it has to go away, it goes away. Right? So these are the three instructions it is given. Swami says the Ishavasya Upanishad gives for people like you and me who have Raga and Dvesha, who have to continue to live in this world but still can claim to lead a yogic life. Not for claiming, but for marching towards yoga itself. Right? And in fact, later there are I think two or three verses which I'll speak about where the Upanishad gives a beautiful way by which Vidya and Avidya can be synthesized, can be brought together. And Sambhuti and Asambhuti, I'll explain those words, can be brought together. The Upanishad says, those who only pursue Avidya get ruined. The exact meaning of that verse is, they enter into blinding darkness who are worshippers of avidya alone. But they enter even greater darkness who verily are worshippers of vidya alone. What is vidya and what is avidya? Vidya is this strong belief and strong understanding that all of what we see is unreal. Right? That is the ultimate wisdom, that is the ultimate knowledge. That whatever you see, whatever is seen and we experience in this world is unreal. So Swami says, or this Upanishad says, that those who stick only to this idea, everything is unreal, I'm going to leave everything and go away. Swami says, you go into deeper darkness than the person who worships avidya. A person who worships avidya is actually a bogi. Right? He looks at this unreal world, he thinks it's real, and he chases it. So Swami says, even a bogi gets ruined, but even a person who goes after vidya alone gets ruined. And that is why the Upanishad says, vidya and avidya, he who knows them both together, he overcomes death through avidya and obtains immortality through vidya. Which means, hold on to that avidya. When you hold on to that avidya, so-and-so is a mother, so-and-so is a friend, so-and-so is a superior, so-and-so is an elderly person, this is a child. You use your discrimination, right? You have to treat them differently. You look at your own life and say, these are my duties towards these people. That's why this bringing together vidya and avidya is given, is explained as bringing together of karma and karma yoga. Karma yoga comes from vidya, spiritual understanding. Karma comes from avidya. What am I supposed to do as a son? What am I supposed to do as a husband? What am I supposed to do as a mother? That comes from avidya. Hold on to the avidya and hold on to the vidya in the form of karma yoga. And then the next instruction it gives is, bring together sambhuta and asambhuta. What is that which is sambhuta? It means the manifest and the unmanifest. This is a little more subtle to understand, and there's a very, very beautiful explanation that is given for this. What is unmanifest? The unmanifest are the vasanas in the mind. What is manifest? The desires are manifest. The vasanas, we have no clue of what is their past life impressions, as they say. We don't know how they rule our lives. We know that something is making me make a choice, but I don't know what it is. I am scared of some things, I don't know what makes me scared of them. There are some kind of people I'm very fond of, I don't know why I'm fond of them. Because these are vasanas which are not available to us. These are in the subconscious mind. These are unmanifest. The manifest are the desires, the raga and dvesha. So again, the Upanishad says, they enter into blinding darkness who aim to conquer the unmanifest cause of creation, and they enter into even greater darkness who aim to conquer the manifest creation itself. The inner meaning of this is, the vasanas are born out of the basic ignorance that I am a separate individual from the master, from the Lord. Right? So those who try to overcome that, those who want to grasp Advaita without going through the process of Karma Yoga, right? Oh, I am not this body, so I am nobody's son, I am nobody's father, I am nobody's husband. You give up everything and you try to reach. The Upanishad says you will go into darkness. Those who get lost is who start chasing the manifest, the desires. So you have to bring together the sambhuti and the asambhuti. How does that happen? It says with viveka and vairagya. Vairagya is the tool which is used to overcome the vasanas, where you constantly keep repeating to yourself, I am not this body, this world is unreal, I am not this personality. But at the same time, you use viveka to filter raga and dvesha. What is a good desire, what is a bad desire? Based on the different stages of life, you use your discrimination to choose what is to be done, what is not to be done. So bringing together of this viveka and vairagya is the other approach. So Swami says the Ishavasi Upanishad gives us this opportunity to lead a yogic life within the world. Where you say, as a person, what is my duty right now? But constantly the mind is dwelling on the ultimate. In one sentence, if you have to say, as Swami says, hands in the society, heads in the forest. Right? Swami in one line gives this whole description. Continue to do what you're supposed to do. Filter out what you choose, what you like and dislike based on the principles of morality and duty, and let the mind always be fixed on the goal. And automatically you become a yogi. But for all of us, there is another very, very beautiful and very easy and a very loving way of achieving this. Talking about a perfect yogi, Krishna gives a wonderful definition for a perfect yogi. Krishna says a perfect yogi is one who is an atmarati, atmatripta, and atmanyeva santushta. Right? Three phrases he uses to define a yogi. Atmarati, he is attached only to the higher self. Atmatripta, whatever satisfaction he seeks only from that self. And atmanyeva santushta, he is complete in himself. He does not need anything from outside. Now if we look at our own selves, if we were to say, which is not wrong, who is the Atma? Isn't it Swami? Now can we redefine a yogi with this replacing Atma with Swami? So who is a yogi or a devotee who can become a yogi? Who is an Atmarati, who is constantly attached to God. Who is an Atmatripta, who does not seek anything from the world. He says, whatever I want, I will seek it only from my Lord. I don't need any benefits from anybody around, from this world. I don't need anything. I will do what I'm supposed to do, and I will take remuneration only from my Lord. And finally, he is an Atma Santushta, one who leads life only to please this self, only to please Swami. Right? When we talk about we having Raga and Dvesha, how do you use Viveka to filter Raga and Dvesha? There should be some touchstone, right? So now you look at Swami and you say, Swami, I love you, I need to do whatever pleases you. Now my raga and dvesha starts getting aligned to what I think Swami likes and dislikes, isn't it? There is something I like, but Swami, you don't like this, so I don't want this. There is something I don't like, I fear, but Swami asked me to do that. Yes, Swami, what you like, I like. What is acceptable to you is acceptable to me. So in a way, I am breaking free from my raga and dvesha, the prison of my raga and dvesha, isn't it? So a devotee can achieve this through the same process by being attached to the Lord, by saying that whatever comes to me shall come only from the Lord. I will not seek from anybody else. And whatever I do, I will do it only to please this Lord. That's why Swami would often quote the beautiful lines from Bhaja Govindam. You say, Yogaratova Bhogaratova Sangaratova Sangha Vihinaha Yasya Brahmani Ramate Chittam Nandati Nandati Nandatyeva. Meaning is, one may take delight in yoga or one may take delight in bhoga. Yogaratova Bhogaratova. One may want to live in company. One may want to live in detachment. Sangaratova Sangavihinaha. But only one who is attached to Brahman, only one who is attached to God is a true yogi. Nandati Nandati Nandatyeva. Only he or she will be in bliss who is attached to the Lord. Right? And that's why Swami says, Swami will often speak about the Gopikas and say they are the greatest yogis. Why? Because they were so attached to that Lord that their raga and dvesha was lost. Their mind was completely sublimated in that Lord and they did not have anything but that goal in front of them. They probably did not think of it as yoga, did not think of it as liberation and so on and so forth, but it doesn't matter. Right? The same yoga is reached by a devotee. Probably I should conclude here, but a last part, I'd like to talk a little. What is the role an avatar plays when we are trying to understand these spiritual truths? When Krishna is giving his discourse to Arjuna, at one point he says, when he's trying to tell Krishna that you have to act whatever happens, what does he say? He says, look at me. I have no desire. I have nothing to achieve. I have nothing to attain. But still I act. And I act in this manner so you can learn from me. Right? So the role of an avatar in a spiritual journey is to set an example among many things. Right? But when we look at Swami, a lot of people might ask, but where is the simple life? Right? Swami lived like a king. Swami drove in a luxurious car. Swami lived in a palace-like home. Swami traveled by flight wherever he went. Now, Professor Venkatraman was beautifully narrating. He was with a group, he was giving a talk. And he said, if any of you have any questions, you may ask. So some of them were asking some questions. There was a young boy in the crowd who was putting up his hand. And all the elders around him were pulling him down. Because they knew that he was a troublemonger and he was known for asking difficult questions. So they didn't want to embarrass the speaker, so they were trying to pull him down. So Venkatraman said, sorry. And I said, why are you stopping him? Let him ask the question. So then the boy asks this question. He says, why did Swami drive around in a BMW car? And again the elder said, keep quiet, keep quiet, keep quiet. And Venkatraman said, no, that's a very good question. It's a very good question that he has asked. And then he said a very beautiful answer. He said, see, you are looking at Swami driving around in a BMW car, but he is not what he is because he drives that car. Even if you were to take that car away from him, it means nothing to him. That is why he is Swami. It is not about what you enjoy, but when it is taken away, it makes no difference to you. When we were talking to Mrs. Ratanlal, she was narrating this very beautiful incident and very profound. In fact, when she narrated it, she said, please don't share it with others. But I feel it should be shared. This was probably in the early 1970s when Swami was setting up the college in Vrindavan. There was a grand procession, I think, for which the chief minister and the governor of the state had attended. Swami himself came in a chariot and all of that grand paraphernalia. The next day, Swami was to visit the governor's house for a royal lunch. So the car was ready and Swami was about to leave. And Mrs. Ratanlal happened to be there to send off Swami. And Swami comes out in an absolutely crumpled robe. The robe is so crumpled, you can make out that it is sweaty and it has not been washed. So she looks at Swami and says, Swami, you're going like this. Do you know where you're going? You're going to the governor's house. You're the royal guest. How can you go like this? Swami said, no, it's fine. It looks good. She said, no, Swami, it is very dirty. It is very crumpled. And in a very soft voice, Swami says, but I don't have another robe. He says, I don't have another robe. And he says, for the past 2-3 days, I'm wearing the same robe. And she was shocked. Here is Swami, who's traveling by cars, traveling by BMWs and Mercedes, flying business class probably in planes. He's a royal guest at the governor's Raj Bhavan. But Swami was still that same Swami. She said, still that same robe will be hung. He will wear a dhoti, put a towel on himself, go to sleep. Next morning, wear the same robe. He was never ever attached to any of these things, right? And that is why I felt this has to be told, right? Otherwise people will say, oh, Swami distributed so many robes, then how many more robes Swami must have had? It's a very beautiful incident which recently I heard. In those days when birthday celebrations used to happen, at the end of it, Swami would sit in the throne in the bhajan hall and would give padnamaskar to all the devotees who would come. Right? In a long row they would come, they would take padnamaskar, Swami would give them prasadam and they will go. So after one such session, Swami was telling one devotee, Swami said, see, now if you take padnamaskar, you will get nice fragrance from my feet. And Swami said, that fragrance is not from my feet, sir. That fragrance is from the scented oil of the hair of those devotees who took padnamaskar. Swami says, but now you see, if a devotee comes and takes padnamaskar, he will think, see this Sai Baba, he puts scent even for his feet. What a very subtle point this is. All the luxuries that you saw around Swami, all the luxuries which appeared like Swami was enjoying, were the luxuries that we thought were luxuries. For him it was nothing. Right? For the devotees appeared like, oh, this is expensive perfume, this is an expensive flower, this is an expensive robe, this is an expensive footwear. We put the scent in our head on his feet. His feet did not need them at all. Because he is a Yogeshwara. For him there is nothing right and wrong, good and bad, likable and dislikable, there is nothing for him. Right? So it is attainable. Swami would often say that, you know, you should never look at Swami and say that, oh, you're beyond. He said, no, it is possible. That's why, as we always like to say, if you look at Swami's life from his childhood till the very end, his physical sojourn on this earth, Swami showed us how you can lead your life when you have absolutely nothing. Like how Swami lived as a small boy. He also showed us how you can live when you have everything, still untouched by any pleasure, any comfort. So with those few words, I'll humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. And I thank you all for your very, very patient listening.